Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Richard Miniter filling in for Frank Gaffney along with Jackie. We're joined now by Sebastian Gorka. Seb Gorka is a military affairs fellow and director at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, an all-around good guy. Seb, what do you think about the Obama administration finally agreeing to provide some aid to the Syrian rebels, some $60 billion? Now, of course, the rebels are saying this morning that that's too little, too late. Does this remind you of Budapest in 1956? Not that you were there, in the sense that, you know, the Hungarians had risen up against the communists. They had risked their lives. Many had died. They waited desperately for U.S. aid. When it finally arrived, the planes landed and they opened the crates, hoping to find guns to fight the Soviets, who they knew were going to come. And instead, they found powdered milk and children's toys. Is this a bit like that?
Oh, Rich, that's a fascinating analogy. I wasn't there in 1956, but my father was sitting in a communist prison with a life sentence because he'd resisted the Soviet takeover of Hungary in 45. So this very much is something that's on my mind. Yeah, I think it's indicative of something we have seen for many, many years now, and that is the complete absence of strategic thought and strategic action in Washington. And this isn't a party political issue. This is under Republican and Democrat administrations, but it has become even more so recently. I would point you towards a fascinating article called The Consequentialist in that famously right-wing newspaper called The New Yorker, which, of course, had incredible access to the White House, and 3 years ago tried to get to the bottom of what is the Obama administration's foreign policy. And this reporter spoke to everybody, including the commander-in-chief. And basically, the article proves that we, despite being the most powerful nation in the world, don't think and act strategically. There's a quote in that article from the president which goes as follows: having overarching doctrines and strategies can get you in trouble. Unbelievable. And I think our attitude to the whole Arab Spring phenomenon, not just Syria, proves the point that they do not think in terms of what is the national interest, who are our real allies, and what do we have to do to protect U.S. interest in that specific region of the world. So I just think it's another indication. Too late, too little.
Seb, I want to ask you about the coverage in the Wall Street Journal, coupled with the Obama administration's ostensible narrative, which is that there's a divide among the Syrian rebels between the extremists and the what they call the moderate face of the rebellion. What do those words mean, if anything, in this context? What is the moderate face of the Syrian rebellion?
What a wonderful question. Let's strip all this, blather away and remove the categories that are a product of our own mirror imaging that have really no resonance or applicability in the region. Syria is run by Alawites. Alawites are a minority form of Shiism. They are a Shia sect, which is deemed by most of Islam, at least the 80% of the world that is the Sunni, to actually be a heresy, that this is a Muslim heresy. They are not Muslims. As a result, there are countries such as Qatar, which is being incredibly active and doing things that actually are much more strategic than we are doing, that see the future of Syria purely in terms of the Shia versus Sunni divide. There is everything to play for. This isn't about, a group of Jeffersonian moderates mixed up with some Salafi jihadists. This is about the supremacist vision of a Sunni push in the region, which means that Iran and their proxy states, such as the Alawites, will be taken down, taken out of power. So the 1400-year argument over who should inherit the, you know, the crown of Islam, should it be the followers of Ali, the Shia, or the followers of the Sunni tradition, can be settled in a kinetic war. That's the reality behind this conflict. It's nothing to do with, you know, the establishment of representative democracy.
Well, hang on there, Seb. I mean, there's something else going on here. If you look at the Gulf states, not just Qatar, but Bahrain, Kuwait, and so on, and the Saudis, who are playing a big role in the Syrian fight,
sure.
They are terrified by an atomic Iran. They see that the endless march to build, you know, deadly weapons. They see that the Iranians are the largest funders of international terrorism in the world, not just against us, but also against the Sunnis. They see that Iraq is, which was they see as a Sunni country, increasingly dominated by the Iranians. And by the way, Syria has really two significant allies in the world, Iran and Russia. It's Russia's last Arab ally. If some of these Sunni extremists want to push Russia's last Arab ally out of the Middle East and take out a key Iranian satellite, shouldn't that be good enough? Do we have to have perfect enemies for an evil regime, or can we take take imperfect enemies and take what we can in the bargain?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is you know, involving all the states of the region, and the idea of a Shia bomb is absolutely terrifying to those people who deem themselves to be the only rightful followers of Muhammad. So, you know, if Iran does go nuclear, then Saudi Arabia will not sit on its hands and will simply purchase a nuclear weapon, whether it's from North Korea or from Putin. Likewise, let's not forget, there is a non-Arab player in all this that is also very, very heavily affected, and that's Turkey. If there is a nuclear-capable Iran, it's not just Saudi Arabia that's going to up the ante, it is also going to be Turkey, which has found itself in a new position, rejected by Europe, which is getting into bed with Moscow and with other actors as being potentially one of the biggest strategic players. And let's not forget, what was Turkey less than 100 years ago? In 1914, it was still the Ottoman Empire. It was the last embodiment of the caliphate. So, yeah, all of these issues must be understood as geostrategic ones at the highest level, but also historically informed issues that go back 1,400 years. It's not just Qatar. It's not just Saudi Arabia. It's Turkey. It's Iran. It's the Alawites. And it's one big strategic competition.
But if you talk to leaders in the region, as I've done and you've done, what they say repeatedly is they see an absence of U.S. leadership, that the Turks are making – the Turkish trade with Iran, for example, has more than doubled in the past 5 years, that they're taking Iranian investment into their economy as well, presenting Iran with a unique opportunity for profit-making, which they can't invest in too many other countries, so that's a real important outlet for their economy. They're building bridges with Iran because they see that the U.S. is just not playing ball. We're not – strongly opposed to Iran. We have these toothless sanctions, and they think that they're going to have to make the best deal they can with the inevitable. The Sunnis, on the other hand, feel threatened by the Iranians and just can't make a deal, where the Turks seem prepared to, and the Russians are essentially allied with the Iranians for this move, and more than 300 of the atomic engineers at Bushehr are Russian. So this is all an extension. I mean, in some ways, Syria is a Russian cat's paw, isn't it? And aren't we seeing a return to the lines we saw before 1990? I'm not saying a new Cold War, but where Russia is much more aggressive in its foreign policy and much more pointedly anti-American.
Sure. I mean, this is the, you know, one of the key issues that is forgotten. That, you know, Fukuyama and Huntington tried to convince us in the 1990s that ideology is dead. But it's not dead. The thing that connects Syria to Russia, to Iran, even to Saudi Arabia or to the Brotherhood is one and the same, and it is anti-Americanism. Whether it is Shia, whether it is Turkic, this is the proof that ideology is alive and well. To your broader point, we are either not present or we follow doctrines and policies that just do not match the reality of the situation. Let's look at, you know, democratic peace theory. Both Republicans and Democrats have been following this idea that the promotion of democracy will make America safe. Well, not if after the Arab Spring, the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been committed since 1928 to the reestablishment of theocratic caliphate across the world if those people win the democratic elections. This is the Hamas effect. And this is, let's remember, how did Hitler come to power? It wasn't through a palace coup. It was through free elections. So, you know, it is either an absence of policy or policies which make us more in danger than we were before. That's the reality, and that's what we have to wake up.
Thanks, Seb. We've been talking to Sebastian Gorka from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Always enlightening when you look at the big strategic picture from the brightest Hungarian we know, Sebastian Gorka. And great strategic sense. You should also check out his book, Fighting the Ideological War, Winning Strategies from Communism to Islamism. Thanks, Seb.
Thank you, Rich.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.